mean, I understand that girls don't have genitals hanging out of their body unless they have prolapse, in which case they should probably go see a surgeon. But, oh, prolapse, should I explain that? Ian knows what it is.
I know what it is. Okay.
Ian was pre-med, so he should know this.
It's a generic term. Yeah, I mean, it can also describe when you have a stroke and part of your face just kind of...
Right. So prolapse in a...
Yeah, I know what a prolapse is.
Okay. No, well, okay.
Well, I guess you could explain
I'm not just talking to you, then. I'm talking to the thousands of people who rely on me for medical information.
All right.
Ian was a pre-med, so he will back me up on this. Prolapse in a female gynecological term, which isn't a word. My wife told me this because old women would call... She used to work for a gynecologist, and she was the receptionist. Mm-hmm. Work in the office, and old women would call and say, honey, my guts are falling out of my gyne, you know? They wouldn't say that, or be so lighthearted
sure
about
would.
It. And she would...
Ralph Crandon would tell them straight to the
room. One of these days, old lady. Pow! So this old woman called her one day and said, my uterus is hanging out of my vagina.
Hear the voice.
So, Ian, go ahead and, since you're probably more prepared than me for this, why don't you name a bunch of this subgenre that has followed the Wes Anderson films in tone and style.
In vague tone and style, I guess. Well, he wrote co-wrote two of his movies after Rushmore. He Tenenbaums and A Life Aquatic were both co-written with a guy named Noah Baumbach. Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm probably mispronouncing.
And, it's Baumbach, I think.
Did a film called Kicking and Screaming, which was about a bunch of sort of college-age guys that were just about to be done being college-aged, and they were each going through different phases of sort of arrested development. One was, I think, dating like a 17-year-old, and one was just, the main protagonist was just going through the sort of what am I going to do with my life kind of thing. And so it was a more generic film, I guess, in terms of it being, it was sort of like a romantic comedy buddy picture / college movie that had a couple of good jokes in it. And I remember the one section in it that I remember the most is that Eric Stoltz is in it as like an older guy, but he's a bartender, and he would occasionally talk about how, like, you know, hey, the third time I took my 20th century economics class, it was like this, and the whole thing is with him is that he's a bartender, and he ended up marrying a professor.
Right.
Like the third time he took some other class, and that he's decided he's just going to be a lifelong student, and that's right. Just what he does. So it's, you know, in terms of finding your place in life, you don't always have to kind of fit this mold of. I think that is the conflict for the main protagonist, is that his father like has some kind of apartment set up for him in New York, and is going to get him an interview with a law firm or something, and it's like, hey, you know, this is all set up for you. Just go jump right into it, and he's getting that whole idle, rich, existential crisis of, right. Is this what I really want to do? And, you know, then there's a lot of cleverness and you know, references to literature and things thrown in there in that one. And then more recently he did a film called, it was kind of almost a parody of this genre, called Squid and the Whale,
which was very critically acclaimed.
Autobiographical.
And very critically acclaimed.
Yeah,
as well.
Very
critically.
And actually kind of short. It was like 70 minutes.
Yeah.
Which I felt was a little bad because it just kind of ends. And it's a little pretentious in the way it ends.
And Jeff Daniels is really, I think, someone who's, like, made for a movie.
Yeah,
like that.
And Laura Linney, again, was in there doing her typical thing.
I hate Laura Linney.
I really don't care for her, but she did what she does. And there's a line in that one that I always remember, and I kind of reference all the time, when Jeff Daniels is essentially this pretentious professor of literature or something, and he's his arrogance and other thing, among other things, have led to the collapse of his family. Yeah. And he doesn't seem to want to take any actual responsibility.
And he's been working on a book, and his wife published the book, and then she kind of beats him.
She's a success if he's sort of a failure. Yeah. He has all these sort of drawn out rationalizations and over intellectualized concepts of why, you know, he's just an artist. He's, you know, he's misunderstood. But he's talking to his youngest son while they're playing a game of table tennis about how the tennis instructor guy, played admirably by Stephen Baldwin, uh-huh. is a Philistine. And he's like, what's that mean? And he says, oh, it's somebody who doesn't appreciate the art or literature, you know, the finer, the good things. And then the kid says, I think I'm a Philistine. He's like, no, you're not. And then the kid's like, no, I think I am. The kid just like, no, yeah, I think I don't want to be like you. And then it's an interesting concept because the older brother is constantly defending his father. Like, he really wants to believe that his dad, being a total blowhard, is just actually correct in that way that the older brother often is, and the younger brother often isn't, because the sort of dichotomy of the way two siblings usually works out is that the firstborn is sort of more inclined to follow and agree with the parents and be more structured, and the secondborn is less inclined and a little less well-structured, basically. Right. And you could almost chalk it up to, I think, sociologically, chalk it to the fact that the parents kind of let the second one kind of figure it out for themselves, and they've gotten a little more lax or something. They're a little less uptight.
Right,
and
that's kind of a, yeah.
So those are two films that were bombed back, and then we'll talk about the Zweigoff stuff, I think, and Blaine wants to really get into Ghost World at some point, because you just saw it, right? Liz accent says that he really wanted to talk about it.
Well, that's
one of the... You could even throw something like American Beauty into this. It is a definite fringe to that, but it has that kind of
It doesn't have the absurdism, and it has a lot more...
It has some absurdism in it.
But the pretentiousness generally has more to do with drama than it does with the stylistic touches.
Not with comedy. It's not ironically, pretentiously comedic.
I'd have to say that the pretentiousness with Wes Anderson stuff isn't generally the comedy. It's
you
the style.
So?
Yeah, it is.
He does it stylistically.
I think he's doing that, like, God, I would probably be guilty of this too, because he thinks it's a little funny.
I understand that, but...
And I think it is in some cases.
I understand that, but I mean...
You have to laugh at it.
Well, when you do that with music choices and filmic things like shot selections or like that.
People think it's serious, or they'll think it's funny in either way. You're like,
But it's pretentious both ways is another problem, though, is that you think so highly of yourself that this is okay to do, when the standard for everyone else is you play whatever Creed song is the most popular while there's a dance sequence going on
that. You have to do
that. I understand that. Okay, so the Zweigoff stuff, I think, is more... accessible to some people because he was actually making films before Wes Anderson.
Oh yeah.
And he's also he's definitely a different type of director. A lot of these other people who've been following Wes Anderson stuff, I don't know who directed Tadpole, it's a very similar type of thing. They're all younger directors. Mm-hmm. Zweigoff kind of looks like he was a porn star back in the 70s.
And Zweigoff he's not an art guy.
He's yet. Not. He's.
I watched the special features on Art School Confidential. Yeah. And he talked about how he's not one of these idle rich people. And he's like, I used to move refrigerators. That's what I did.
He's just a guy with like an interesting sense of like what's funny to him and stuff like that. The Zweigoff stuff is it differs, and I almost think that only Ghost World should be included in this sort of thing. But I'm going to talk about the rest of it anyway. His style is more blunt. If you think about Bad Santa, Art School Confidential. The comedy is blunt, and it's something that like comes out of the fact that people are,
people are messed up.
People are messed up, and when they say something they shouldn't say at certain times, and it's very blunt, and it's more hit you over the head a little bit. Art School Confidential was kind of a mishmash of different, of the two styles.
Funny, and then it got way too serious. But
Bad Santa is outrageously funny. When I first saw it, I was just floored by it because I wasn't really expecting how far it was going to go over the top. The thing that describes the movie the best is the line where Billy Bob Thornton's sitting in the locker room getting dressed, and what's his name, the little midget dude? I always forget the guy's name. I used to know it. Tony something. He comes up and he says, "Where the hell were you?" And he goes, "I beat the shit out of some kids today. I feel real good about myself." Because like, he doesn't explain why he did it. But then the guy's like, "What the hell is wrong with you?" But all he said was that, because it's funny. These kids were threatening the little fat kid, which he's kind of grown an affection for, and he beats the crap out of these, like, 13-year-old punks, you know? And he's this, like, drunken 45-year-old man with gray hair who's, like...
He's a failure.
Yeah. And, gosh, yeah, he is a failure. He's an absolute failure. And that has as much to do with... it's not, like, a circumstantial thing. It's just him.
It's the theme that fits all these kinds of movies, is that they're about failures. They're not about the Jack Ryan quarterback.
Yeah, but I mean, I think that you could say that about any comedy. All comedy is based out of the fact that...
Sometimes, but the thing is...
I don't think it's sometimes.
It's the conclusion. In the conclusion of some comedies, they do get to, the girl, they get the girl and so on and so forth, and they get to seem cool and they get to win.
Name me a Farrelly Brothers movie that isn't about the main characters being failures.
Yeah,
but they always win
like
in
that.
The end of that.
Yeah, they don't. Not Kingpin. Like,
really, in a
Dumb and Dumber,
like in a comedy, you don't think it's really funny. Like if you know, there's like a, like you know, the jock kind of type that you were talking about, kind of character. They're not like really likable. So
that's an action film. That's an action film, or basically that's what that is. That doesn't. In drama, they're supposedly real people. In comedies, it's people who are very bad at something.
John Cusack 80s comedies, you know, Hot Pursuit, Better Off Dead. He ends up with the one that he wanted originally, but he ends up, in your words, with the one that's good for him.
Yeah, but I don't think that...
With Daphne Zuniga and that one where they are on the road trip.
But I mean, that's what happens in Rushmore. That's what happens in Rushmore.
He doesn't end up with a chick in Rushmore, does he?
Yeah, he's the Asian chick. He dances with her at the end.
Oh, well, that doesn't mean anything.
It's the chick. He ends up with her. It's very pointed that's what's happening, is that he's accepted who's right for him instead of this
dance and stuff. They switch partners and all that.
It's getting to the point where that he's getting rid of this pipe dream thing where he's now not reaching for things out of his element. It's that sort of thing, like accepting his status or whatever.
Accept the status.
I don't,
and you know, as opposed to shoot the moon and then get them right at the end.
So I think that the failure thing is kind of just something that all comedy is based on, because you have to, you can't have a main character that's, you know, your main character can't be Bruce Lee in a comedy.
Yeah,
it's not some guy, you know. That's one thing, is that like a badass character is awesome in something like Ronin.
Yeah.
Some guy who, you know, I mean, some guy who suddenly at the end turns into some superpower and blows everything. It's awesome to see in some movies, and I really...
What color is the boathouse?
Exactly.
What color is the boathouse? Yeah. If you can just tell me what color the boathouse is. I don't
right.
know.
Sean Bean's not a very good spy.
No, and he's always the bad guy, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, there's Sean Bean's going to be the bad guy.
Yeah, 006. I don't know. You know, I think that these are always about failure. For instance, we're watching Howard the Duck right now. It's not... This guy isn't a failure. It's not funny. It's not a
guy. But he's a duck.
Yeah. He's not.
Duck.
Gosh, man. How terrible.
He got a gimmick.
Who played Howard the Duck's voice?
I don't know. The one with the
it doesn't matter.
Internet connection.
That's true. Internet.
You have Wi-Fi in your Windows 98.
He does. When he turns it on, though, the entire thing shuts down.
It's like, what?
Well, let's get into Ghost World. What are your impressions about
Well,
about
I
that?
Can't... Like, I can't really... speak to it, because like I can't really
you
see
you just it. Saw it though right
I just saw
so
it
so I
like,
haven't
I
seen
can't
it in a while so
tell us why or why not you think this is something that is the same sort of subgenre as a Wes Anderson film.
Well, it's more
it's about totally different characters. These are about people who are super conscious of irony, and they're super conscious of irony, and that they're especially
the sincerity
of especially the Birch and Buscemi characters. Scarlett Johansson is one who enters the real world very quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
And Birch is resentful toward her for that.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I can't like really draw any like real comparisons between Wes Anderson films and.
Well, I mean, in terms of like the comedic style, like it's
well,
a dry
humor. Well, yeah,
they
use like it's like a more of a dry humor, and they use like it's like really witty, like you know, like they use like references from like I don't want to like maybe like pop references, you know, like from you know. Like I don't know, like
pop
books
music.
And you know music,
right.
Like you know, yeah, like world.
I seem to. It's been a while, but I seem to remember that there was there's some redneck guy with nunchucks out in front of.
That was funny.
Yeah,
like and that's
drinking
one of those.
A 40
yeah, and that's one of those random touch things that like the Wes Anderson stuff does pretty well, which is that it's not so. it's not something that's always meaningful to anything plot-wise, but something will pop up that's just kind of there, and you're like, what the heck?
And that's what the Holy Dynamite took to the nth level, I think.
Yeah.
Sort of throw in all that.
Yeah.
Don't just take all the
totally random, weird.
Make a character that does that all the
time. It ends up working for most of it. I everyone I know loves Napoleon Dynamite, and the people that I know who really love it are people who are not super into film, which is interesting. It's a movie made for everyone.
Like,
I think it's a lot of people laugh at that kind of character. And it's not like an Anderson thing where I think people see like a little bit of themselves in these sort of failed characters. I think with Dynamite, it's a lot of people look at it like, look at this stupid geek, this is funny.
Everyone I know who watches it is always also people who are like touched by.
Yeah, it's like an endearing.
By him because there's a few moments where things happen to him and you feel really sorry for him while you're watching him. The way that like certain other people in the school and what's interesting about Napoleon Dynamite is. The people who are cool in the school are like they look like if they even went to like Mac High they would be cast off.
I went to Mac High.
Yeah, Ian went to Mac High. No. Here's the thing: you look like a normal person, even with your freaky Wes Anderson thing going on. You still look. I mean, the guy who's like the cool jock in Napoleon Dynamite looks like he's retarded, and the girl who's the hot cheerleader chick.
Is that movie set in the '80s? It definitely had a feel like everyone was stuck that way.
Yeah, they didn't really specify that. Yeah. I don't think it was because the uncle, whatever his name is, Rico, talks about being in school in 80-something.
John Greaves.
Yeah.
That's also, they do that in the Wes Anderson, especially in the Royal Tenenbaums, that you don't, like, really know, like, you know, what.
Right, yeah. And I thought that was one of the interesting things about Darjeeling was that. Right, and one of the interesting things about Darjeeling was it dated itself automatically because you see the iPod, you see other things like the Wi-Fi connector. He's looking for a connector.
And everything. Exactly,
like
that.
Right, but I mean, they talk.
Because
I mean,
they have 50 hertz
but that one guy comes. The guy who Owen Wilson's assistant is like has this whole like Wi-Fi setup going on and stuff like that, and. Owen Wilson line was, the guy says, why are you being such a jerk? He's like, I don't know, why are you so bald? You know?
He's like, I'm sorry.
Like he's serious right there, too. Like, yeah, he's like, is that like being an albino?
And when he quits, he's like, oh, was I just mean to, like, I don't even remember what his name
was. Terry, I think, or something like that.
Was I just mean to Terry?
Brendan, something like that, yeah. I don't know, so, you know, I think that it's weird because when you think about these comedies, I think, have a lot in common with, and you can't really.
Can we get back to Ghost World real quick?
Yeah.
Just remind me how it ends. I remember something about a bus stop. She's just sitting there.
Yeah, the end is.
Just end at the bus stop. Like,
remember, she has the whole romance thing with Steve Buscemi, and then
which is
like
creepy.
That, right? Yeah, it's creepy.
Yeah, and then then she gets over him and stuff, and then she gets over Scarlett Johansson's character. Mm-hmm. You know, and
she decides the only thing she can do is leave.
She just leaves. It ends with her going off on a bus.
Yeah, and she gets on the bus and drives away. And
it's the same bus stop that that old guy was waiting at the whole entire time.
And she's basically leaving this life, which for her has been this cyclical thing that
she gets. Going to school? She's actually going somewhere, right? Because didn't she get accepted to some academy because of
her
summer school thing?
Yeah, she went to the summer art thing and she entered that, the black.
Yeah, yeah.
Kentucky Fried Chicken thing. And I think she got disqualified, though, because they thought it was, racist.
Well, it was, but then she was doing it for ironic, postmodern reasons.
Yeah.
I think,
I don't think she got the school thing because, that automatically disqualified
her. I just don't remember if it had an optimistic sort of, she's going to go off and she's going to become an artist.
It didn't strike me as very optimistic. It struck me as just something where it was like almost a desperate act of getting out of this rut.
Just going to leave, but wherever you go, your problems are there,
So
it kind of let you draw your own conclusions, pretty much.
It was draw your own ironic comedy book. Go to page 108 if you want her to drive away on the bus and not know what happened. We'll be right back. Big Lebowski is really this type of film.
Oh, yeah.
Because the comedy in it is almost always something that doesn't have anything to do with the plot. And in this movie's case, there is no plot to speak of. The plot is so convoluted and Raymond Chandler-ish, which they've expressly said it's a Raymond Chandler thing, that the plot becomes unimportant. And what's important is nothing.
About his rug or something?
It is. I mean, it's about these characters. In the beginning, the guy, as you know, Sam Elliott says, or Sam Elliott says, he says, there's in his rambling way, that there's a man for every time, and that the man for this time with the whole thing was Saddam. You know, like he talks about how like the thing that defines this time, which is the early '90s, which is like an aimless era of like nothing. Like nothing happens in the early '90s. And the big thing that happens is the Gulf War, which is nothing. The whole thing about the dude is that, like, he talks about how he's a man for this time. Yeah. And that's a joke in itself, because nothing happens in this time. And he is, as he says, the laziest man in Los Angeles, which puts him in the running for the laziest man in the whole world.
Yeah.
Or Los Angeles, as he calls it. And so the Big Lebowski is something where it's funny, where they talk about, they say, well, the Raymond Chandler-esque plot makes it so that, you know, the plot's unimportant. But what they don't say then is, what is important? It has no point. If the plot doesn't matter, and there's no really sort of theme to it, and the main character is the laziest person on the face of the earth, and the whole point is that the dude abides, what the hell is that movie about? It's about nothing, and it's fantastic. I was reading recently in...
more stylized and funny.
I was walking past... I was waiting for some test to happen. I was walking past a bunch of teachers' offices in Founders Hall at HSU, and somebody had pinned up on their door a thing from the Chronicle a couple weeks ago. They now have a monthly seminars in New York, Los Angeles, a couple other places that are just about the Big Lebowski, where people present like scientifically written papers about disseminating this and talking about like how meaningful it is and all this stuff. And it's become this, not a huge cultural thing, but an academic thing in terms of not just film, but sociological stuff.
Mm-hmm. You can do that with anything.
You can. You can. But it's funny because this movie is literally about nothing. It's like, it is totally like the Seinfeldian thing, except for it's got their own style to it.
Yeah.
And it's got these, it's got those absurd touches that fall into this sort of thing, and it's got they never go too pretentious, but there's the things in there like, the guy's like, I'd really like you to come see my dance cycle. The guy who asked for his rent comes to his landlord. Hey, will you be? He's like, I'll be there, man.
I was making fun of that kind of stuff. And then Julia, whatever her name is, a redhead.
Is
totally one big.
Oh, absolutely.
Slapping and, face on that.
And when, what's his name? David Thewlis is sitting there.
Coitus?
Yeah. And when David Thewlis is there, when he goes back and he's like, who's this guy? And she's like, that's whatever, the video artist. And then, like, the person calls on the phone and she talks to him in, like, Spanish and they all start laughing and she laughs hysterically and David Thewlis is laughing hysterically on the phone. He's looking at them like he's, like, what the hell is going on? And it doesn't ever explain it. Yeah. Like, stuff like that, you know? Like, so I would put that in this sort of category. It's almost just like saying this is a weird comedy because the comedy doesn't come from situations. It comes from...
Well, it comes from the situations, but it doesn't come from a structured narrative.
No, it usually comes from absurdism within the situation.
Yeah,
which is almost more
still
like
a situation. I mean, if you think about how real life a lot of times will have very absurd situations within it, I mean, truth stranger than fiction kind of stuff, I think that the comedy does come from the situations, but what you were really... what I got from what you were saying there is that there's no narrative structure. There's no... What does the protagonist want? So he wants a new rug. Does he even get a new rug at the end? I don't think he does. And Donnie dies.
Reimbursement.
Yeah, and Donnie dies. And,
right.
I mean, so the whole structure of, like, a tragedy or a comedy in terms of the flow and the rising action, there are aspects of that, but there's no... Like, doesn't come out of the struggle for the...
No, it's just strange things. It's just strange things that happens in there. Like, gosh, just offbeat stuff. But, I mean, the Sam Elliott stuff that he even says at the end, he's like, Donnie died, and that was a bummer, but I happen to know there's a little Lebowski on the way, so everything kind of evens itself out in the end. And he's like, it was a great story, and I think that was what's important, is it was a fun 2 hours. We sat here and...
Sarsaparilla.
Like,
yeah. That's good.
We ordered some more good sarsaparilla. So, I don't know. It's an interesting genre.
You think that's more common humor, though? I mean, that's even in Blood Simple and Raising
no,
Arizona.
No, it totally is. But
I
mean, but those both have... Bless
you. Miller's Crossing had that. And,
yeah.
Barton Fink. The ones that didn't have that as much, well, I didn't see that George Clooney one.
But those all have plots that are, yeah. You know, I mean, Miller's Crossing is, you know, they're all fantastic films. A lot of people love Blood Simple. I think that's really their weakest film. And
it was their first.
It was, yeah. It's kind of hard to blame them for that.
Dan Hedaya, Kicking the Nuts.
It's got some great stuff in it. But The Big Lebowski is the only one they've done that's really, like, that really sort of falls in the sort of thing. And that's what I'm saying, is that it's kind of hard to put it in there, because you really just kind of say, well, it's a Coen Brothers film, because it follows the style. It's got the same sort of shots and the moving dollies on the floor and stuff like that.
It's like Anderson is using, they're using some of the same character. Yeah. Was that the first time they used Goodman?
He was in Barton Fink.
That was before that, right?
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah.
Goodman,
Tichiro.
Gosh, it might have been the first time they used Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, Jeff Bridges was, and well, he wasn't their first. Yeah, and he wasn't their first choice for that either. They actually wrote the other characters for those actors. They wrote Buscemi's character and Goodman's characters for those actors. And they had written this dude idea, and they had talked about a couple other actors they were thinking of. It's in all the special features.
I just don't remember.
And they said they kind of just happened upon Jeff Bridges because, like, they were running out of options and they had to start shooting. And it didn't sound like they were ever super happy with the result of him. But I think he was perfect for it.
He was really good. I'm not sure what they... they modeled it after a friend of theirs. Walter, they
knew this other guy, too. Walter was based off... what's his name? The guy who made Red Dawn.
Yeah.
Do a pitch. You go first so I can think of one.
No, I don't have an idea either. I started working on a couple different ones. I started coming up with minor evolutions of things, but I think in the end I fell on my face. I thought about doing an adaptation combo, kind of, you know, do it about like a writer who's trying to make a real self-aware comedy, but right. He ends up living his whole life as like being very self-aware and comedic as a defense mechanism, but then I realized that was too much like my own life.
Okay.
And I thought,
here you go. You think of one. I'm gonna try to ad lib this one. I'm gonna try to completely go off the top of my head.
No, that was mine right there.
That was it.
About a writer who writes a self-aware comedy and realizes it's about himself and then he hangs himself. Eats a turkey sandwich and kills himself.
But a Wes Anderson.
Can it be? Can it be
like
corned beef on rye?
No,
that's what you got to do in a pitch. You got to be able to change when the producer says.
Instead of a guy, can it be an
anthropomorphic dog who talks?
No, it's not a dog. It could be an animation, though.
Okay.
Good. Where's the happy ending, though?
Well, it turns out that he didn't actually die, and that was all his script.
No.
How about that? Okay, here's my pitch. A king of a country. He's a king, really young age, of some European country. One of the only few ones left with has any sort of monarchy. And the country folds and goes under and has to be, like, annexed into France or something like that.
Okay.
And so this person who was king at the age of 18 then has to move to New York, and he becomes a music store clerk. That's the record scratch sound. And then he finds that all the hip, ironic people in New York...
They don't appreciate his royalty.
Exactly. And so he decides that he's going to hang himself. The end. Which one of those?
But he doesn't hang himself, right?
Right. At the end, it's all a script that Ian wrote. You know, this wasn't an easy thing to do a pitch for, because these movies are generally something that. Is not something, like, you can't really just say...
You kind of, like, figure out the narrative, then you start inserting the absurdist
Because if you want to make it sound like it's got some sort of funny stuff to it, you have to explain in detail, like, these little things that happen throughout the plot.
And
you can't really do
it
like that. So you kind of have to describe a drama to do one of these
films.
I
think funny until the end, and then I would just kill himself.
I personally don't think yours would be funny at all. Just a guess.
But he couldn't kill himself, right? It's a Wes Anderson film.
Well, no, it's a film that I'm pitching that's like a Wes Anderson.
He can kill himself. What's wrong with that, Blaine?
Because they don't...
What's wrong with suicide, Blaine?
It has to have a happy ending.
Suicide is painless.
Oh, well, maybe the other characters
many
will learn a lesson
changes.
From
yeah, exactly. Okay. People learn that things do have consequences, as opposed to in all the other movies where they commit suicide, fail, and then there's sort of no consequences after that.
They get to be on the internet.
You've seen Idiocracy, right? You've seen Idiocracy? I mean, not everyone agrees with me on this, but I think one of the funniest things that I remember about that, I've seen it twice now, and I still just, like, the main things I remember are the images of Terry Crews with his long, straight hair firing a machine gun at the State of the Union address. A celebratory gesture of firing his machine guns off.
And the coat of arms and stuff like that. They're like guns.
I don't know. I mean, people are, like, so split over these movies. I think that... I think Idiocracy is fantastic. I thought it was really funny. That's neither here nor there, but
no, it's good.
I think it's a funny movie. I mean,
I enjoyed it.
It had his weaknesses. It definitely had his weaknesses. Luke Wilson, like, being the main character of anything is never a good idea. I don't think
what it was making fun of was that's where it was kind of drawing its humor from as well. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah. Oh, totally. Yeah.
But it was still funny.
Yep. And it's like, hey, my judge, you the biggest butthead. You started.
Yeah, he did. It's all his fault.
Your fault.
Beavis and Butthead was always so much smarter than.
Oh no, I know. I would like.
It really
like,
was.
I should try to. I have the first season of DVD, and I should actually sit and watch. I got it partially for the videos.
Yeah, right.
Which is, I know,
so you can watch a whole bunch of Violent Femmes videos and stuff.
Yeah.
Ah, Four Non Blondes. I really wish I could watch that video again.
Exactly. But Guar.
Yeah, Guar.
When the Guar video was finally on, and they spent the whole time talking about how to like. Best maximize being able to ensure they could watch a Guar video during it, and so they ended up not enjoying it at all. It's the story of my life.
Yeah.
Like, okay, now maybe if like we each like give it shifts. But yeah, that show was done.
You know what's weird is that like Mike Judge has made two of.
I've watched.
That's the thing. That's it.
Well, he's
made these two movies that are like to me are like fantastic and really great comedy movies and just straight up great comedy movies. And then King of the Hill is the most boring pile of trash. You know, it's like take the most boring. It's like King of Queens or Yes Dear, but not even that funny. And then it's animated.
Yeah.
There's little jokes in there that are funny. The thing is, you just have to decide to watch it. And I almost never feel like watching. Greg Daniels, who I think did the U.S. adaptation of The Office, which I enjoyed, was involved in it, and Mike Judge. So it's two people that I give thumbs up on, and it's just I'm like, well, whatever. It doesn't matter.
I still feel, you know, I've seen it. Every once in a while I watch the episode of The American Office, and it's always kind of funny to me, and it's definitely better than... I really hate TV commercials for shows. NBC's commercials for their shows never do them justice. Yeah, they never do them justice.
They always have a voiceover guy just like making it sound like you're so invested, aren't you? You know? Like,
yeah.
Well, da-da-da-da-da, finally get together.
Yeah, who gives a crap? Yeah. And so I'm already like kind of biased toward it. I really enjoyed the British one. Mm-hmm. And I still, the tone is different. People try to say, well, it's the same thing, but it's funnier, the American one. It's not. It's a different type of thing.
Yeah.
It's the British ones are painful.
Oh,
they are painful,
well,
and they're deliciously
so
painful.
If you watched
deliciously painful.
Some of the U.S. ones, especially recently, like there was like one that was actually pretty. Like I was kind of depressed after watching it, and then I watched the new South Park, and I laughed again.
Knocked you back
But no, I mean, they don't. What Carell does is different than what Gervais does with that character, and they're similar. They're both kind of like, ultimately you realize they're not terrible people. They're just really off and weird, and they're the failures, you know? So this ties into Wes Anderson. But it's definitely different. And you're right. I think Gervais just loves getting into that, like, this is not funny anymore. This is just so, like, this is just painful, and it's like, and I think he... And I've heard him in interviews talk about how he's more influenced by older American television shows, like MASH and stuff, which has a lot of drama in it. So I think for him, what he's doing is he's taking comedy and inserting a lot of drama to it, and then it sort of can still work both ways, I guess.
Right.
What was that? I haven't seen the UK Office in a while, but there was...
He
kept pointing at like this monkey thing there, and it like not saying anything. This was a big
he would giggle, like
You're like,
Yeah.
I haven't seen
like,
any
what
of
is that
them.
You've seen the British ones?
No.
They're really great. It's
I've
it's
seen
some of the best
a lot
TV.
Of the first season of the American Office.
Right.
I haven't been following.
Do you like the American one?
Yeah.
See, now imagine that, but like,
it's quicker. It's two series of six, and then a Christmas special. So it's like the equivalent of. Maybe
it's a season.
It's like a season.
Yeah,
US
it's a season. It's less than.
It's got the same like ultimate. It's got the same the guy and the secretary, mm-hmm. you know, it's the smart ass, the secretary, mm-hmm. aren't really the main characters, but they kind of are, and their love in the relationship, unrequited garbage, is always kind of what seems to sell, and that's sort of what's going on in that as well, and that ends up getting resolved. But, so it's like every character that's in the UK one, there's a version of them in the, yeah. in the US one. I mean, right down to the fat guy Kevin, and then the fat guy.
Yeah, and it's really hard to find fault with that because it, I mean, but Gervais created the US one as well. They
and he wrote one.
Yeah, he like, did. They've written a couple. They also
seen one that
well
they
also the pilot was a direct rip of
oh, that's
the
right.
yeah
directly from the first episode.
And I mean Gervais was approached and they said, do you want to also produce and create this for American TV? And he said, yeah, sure.
Cool.
If you watch it though, it's like the things that happen in there that are funny are like. It really is like painful. It's like this sort of thing where the
like what do you mean?
Have you seen Extras at all? Have you seen Extras?
Yeah,
or, okay.
You showed me.
Okay, so it's like Extras is like The Office except for Gervais's character
is more like
real life him, which is normal and bad things happen to him mm-hmm. because of other people. In The Office, his character is outrageous because. He is so arrogant and so bad at everything he does, except for he's a good salesman, which mm-hmm. they touch on a couple
and
times.
They do that in the U.S. one too.
Yeah,
and
they
I
do.
Like when they do remind you that hey, this guy can actually.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But he wants to. He's a songwriter. He thinks he's a fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then he actually plays, and they're like, "Wow, we're surprised." And
yeah.
some of the funniest things are, gosh, what is his name? What's the sidekick's name in the
Gareth?
Yeah, Gareth. Yeah, this guy's fantastic. It's the one that Dwight is.
He was in the National Guard or something.
Yeah.
So apparently that makes him.
Well, no, he was in the gosh, what do they call it?
The reserves.
No, it's the something army, the territorial army or something like that, yeah. which is like the National Guard version of and it's like an embarrassment to be in that. and he's he thinks he's all badass and everything.
Survive.
But he's this one Ricky Gervais, they had this. They have this conference, and this guy comes to talk to them about what was it? It was the guys.
Was it about sexual harassment?
It was something about that, and but they end up.
Is that the one where they showed the video? The corporate video.
Yeah, I think so.
I think that was some of the funniest stuff. But he would be like, "Oh, hello."
Right. But then Gervais like. He keeps feeling like he has to take charge,
yeah.
and like because he has to be the leader, even mm-hmm. though like no one even
and
cares
doing,
about him.
He's doing mm-hmm. like the Robin Williams good Dead Poets Society thing. He's doing like
right.
Rip this book up. This is wrong.
Yeah,
here's what we're gonna do.
I think that they had the American version of that one too,
yeah,
because that sounded really familiar.
They covered the.
It's great because they do this thing where he goes. Well, I think the funniest thing in the whole series was the guy. He's like, well, let's do some role play. He's like, all right, well, he's like, it's a problem solving thing. And so the guy who's teaching the seminar says, "Okay, well, so I'll be the I'll be." He says, "I'll you're running a hotel. I'll be the person who comes to stay here, and you be the manager." And Gervais goes, "No, I'll be the." He's like, "No, you don't get it." He's like, "No, let's switch it around. I'll be the thing." So he like forces the guy, and he says, "Excuse me, sir. I've got a problem with my room." And the guy's like, "Okay, well, what's your problem?" He's like, "Well." I don't want to stay there. And he's like, well, you're going to, and he's going to be more specific. And he keeps bugging him. Finally, he goes, there's been a rape up there. And like, everyone's just like stunned. And Gervais is like all pleased with himself. Like he stumped this guy. And he's like completely taking this thing out of context. And then while the guy gets angry and leaves, he whips out his guitar and shows everyone this song.
Oh, no, 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 no. Isn't that the one where then you cut to Tim, and he was the gym character. Mm. The guy that was, what's his name? It was the main character in
He's in the Hitchhikers.
Hitchhikers movie, yeah. Played him. And he points and he goes like, took him 2 hours. And he went back to his flat, got the guitar, and came back.
Yeah, right, that's right.
We all
and he sings a song, I think the song he sang that one was Free Love on the Free Love Freeway. Free Love on the Free Love Freeway. And it's like not that funny a song.
Well, Gervais is actually a musician. He was like
yeah.
in a new wave band or something.
And,
yeah, I've seen some of his like comedy, like,
oh man!
Have you seen Politics? And
I've seen something.
He did Politics, and he did Animals, maybe.
Yeah, the Animals. Yeah. Gosh, I don't know. You have to see it. Like, it's just so painful because like it's one of those things. It's embarrassing, but it's manageable with his like. I'm always, like, afraid to watch anything that he does. Like, mm-hmm. every time a new X-Force came out, I was afraid to watch it. I would keep it on my TiVo for a long time before watching it because I didn't want to go through the pain of watching him suffer through terrible things happening, embarrassing things happening to him.
The Bowie thing was such genius, that was really good. I was floored. I was just like, wow.
There's some really, really great stuff.
I think I was working for that movie. It was my free Sunday off, and I was just so burned out. And when I saw that, it was a Bowie thing. And
it worked for you.
Thing, I was just like, wow.
It's perfect.
Time for the turkey sandwich.
The Ian McKellen one, where he
he
tries out for he's so homophobic. He tries out for this play for Ian McKellen. Cool. And he's like,
Ian McKellen is like talking to him, so you're an actress, so that means you get to pretend.
Yeah.
He's
explaining to him like very simply, like you're an actor, that means you pretend to be someone. And he's like, oh, okay, all right. Because he finds out after he's already tried out for this thing and they choose him that the character he's playing is gay.
Wait, who? Which character?
Gervais.
Oh, okay.
And the whole thing is he's trying to seem more respectable as an actor because he's doing this like sitcom that's real popular, but like he wants to.
Yeah. So he wants to branch out. So he gets on this like off. I guess it's not technically Broadway since it's Europe, but at the same time, what's happening is that he's met this guy who's this really manly like office manager guy, and his friends, and they're kind of anti-gay, and so he keeps feeling like he has to prove to them that he's not gay.
But at the same time, the BBC guys that, said, yeah, your idea is good and gave him a show are both gay, right? And
exactly, yeah.
Trouble about that.
Yeah. And so, and the thing is, Gervais in the X-Force is, a normal guy. Mm-hmm. But he screws up this play, opening night.
Yeah.
He keeps, changing the lines to let everyone know he's not gay, even though his character is supposed to be gay.
McKellen screws it in that, too, though, because he all of a sudden throws in, now there's going to be,
a kiss
at the end. And so pretty much just starts, backing away from the guy.
Yeah.
And the guy's chasing after him.
The guy, runs around the stage chasing him, trying to kiss him. And the people are, stunned. And, it ruins the show, and he gets, he just embarrasses himself. Because the two homophobic guys who trying to impress her in the audience watching, of course.
I heard that they might do a third season of that.
Yeah, he's talked about it.
I think he could. I don't know why not. Yeah. I guess he's going to do that thing. That might be cool to see what happens. But that was the last one in season one with Patrick Stewart, right?
Right.
Now I see everything.
Right.
It's just so...
Season one had a lot... it was interesting. I think it was more interesting because...
There was more movie stuff.
And it was because they were just extras the whole time.
Yeah.
And then the second season is he inexplicably gets this TV show made. And he's the, he's the main star. And it's more interesting for his character. But I thought the first season worked better just in terms of the plot.
I think the plot had the character humor. Development had to be what it was going to do. And so, you almost wonder, what would the third season do? Would it be further growth and just more of a commentary on the nature of celebrity? And then I think that's kind of what it would be. But that's funny. I just want to see him do more
and
comedy.
And the girl he hangs out with, his best friend, and then Steve Merchant's character, two of the dumbest, most reprehensible people on the face of the earth. And what kind of makes me angry watching those is bad things happen because of what they do to him, but he continues to associate himself with them constantly. He should have fired Stephen Merchant before he even met him, and he should not be hanging out with this woman because she's always, if he's trying to lie, politely in public to save face on something, she's like, well, you didn't say that 5 minutes ago. You said that, and then who does that?
Yeah.
Nobody actually does that. And he continues to hang out with her, and he's very tender toward her. And at the end, they insinuate that their friendship is something that could grow. I don't know.
The water wall is calling. It lingers, then you forget. Oh, 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 you're a rock and roll suicide. You're too old to lose it. Too young to choose it. And the clock waits so patiently on your song. You walk past the cafe that you don't eat when you've lived too long. Oh no, 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 you're a rock and roll suicide. Shit breaks the snarling as you stumble across the road. But the day breaks instead, so you hurry home. Don't let the sun blast your shadow. Don't let the milk float rob your mind. They're so natural, religiously unkind.
My uterus and other genitals and organs have fallen out of my vagina. What can you do for me? And she, and Kristen went, what? And so she put the lady on hold. She called the doctor frantically and said, some lady's on the phone. Her guts have fallen out of her vagina. And he's like, ah, it's prolapse.